breed of, let's call them conflict entrepreneurs in Russia. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Now, before I get started on Ramzan Kadyrov, just a couple of housekeeping points. First of all, for patrons, Patreon is a very, very handy platform, but it does have its little quirks, shall we say. And I recently heard from three patrons who, without any kind of warning or notice, have essentially been dropped off their patronage of In Moscow Shadows. Now, I can't see any particular rhyme or reason. Two of them were paying monthly, one of them was paying annually, they weren't all paying in the same currency, etc., etc. But nonetheless, just to say that if you are a patron who hasn't received notifications of late, do just check whether or not the system has decided that you've had enough. And on the other hand, of course, if you did drop just simply because you were unwilling or unable to continue to provide support, of course, I'm sorry to see you go, but thanks very much for your support up to now. And finally, also for patrons, if you haven't already noticed, you should have got a notification, but I'm going to be pulling together another one of the patrons-only question and answer episodes. So if you have a question you want to send my way, now's the time to do it. The second thing is something that, again, was raised by a patron simply because of the fact that I tend to start my communications with comrades. And was saying, look, you know, appreciates it's probably just a bit of light-hearted whimsy, but nonetheless, for someone whose background was in the old Soviet Union, this was a little bit jarring. And look, I mean, I think that's fair comment, and I think this is one reason why I wanted to address it, because it's not just simply about how I choose to address people. It's also, I think, a wider point. The reason I use comrades is, yes, in part it is, exactly, it is light-hearted whimsy. And rather than saying, I don't know, friends, patrons, fellow human beings, or whatever. But it also, I think, speaks to this question of, look, the fact that, first of all, the word comrades used in this sense, it is not simply a Soviet thing. It actually speaks back to a tradition of the left that is much broader. And I have a deep and visceral resistance to allowing, whether it was the Soviet era or indeed today's Putin's Russia, to taint and censor language and our understanding of the world. I mean, look, this also speaks, after all, to the whole question nowadays of sort of cancelling or abandoning whole canons, not just words, whether it's Tchaikovsky or whether it's Dostoevsky or whatever. My view is quite simple. If we allow past misuses and misdeeds to, in effect, shape our own language and culture, firstly, we are actually boosting Putin's propaganda because it's used as evidence that the outside world is intrinsically Russophobic and therefore all Russians should feel themselves within a beleaguered fortress and pull together. But perhaps much more importantly, I would say it is ahistorical and it is demeaning to us. The answer is not to surrender these terms, these cultural icons and these notions, but to reclaim them. I refuse to think that the word comrade can and should be regarded simply as a sign of the worst of the Soviet experience, any more than I think that listening to Tchaikovsky today makes you some kind of bedfellow of Russian imperialism. Now look, I'm not trying to tell you what you should be doing. I'm just trying to explain that when I'm using these terms, it's not that I'm actually saying that the Soviet Union was indeed a workers' paradise where everyone lived together in harmony, any more than I'm trying to deny that, obviously, Putin's Russia seeks to mobilise the convenient elements of the Russian cultural canon to its own advantage. It's just that we shouldn't, shall I say, collaborate with that notion. Anyway, let me climb off my soapbox now and get on to the actual meat of this podcast. So, Kadyrov and the conflict entrepreneurs. Ramzan Kadyrov, the deeply unpleasant and violent warlord come monarch, frankly, of Chechnya, is for me, I would say, one of the most striking examples of the conflict entrepreneurs that post-Soviet Russia, and particularly Putin's Russia, has thrown up. Now, I will talk about the concept of conflict entrepreneurs more broadly after the break. But instead, well, we need to appreciate the degree to which Chechnya under Kadyrov has essentially become an oppressive sultanate. In many ways, the irony is that in order to win the Second Chechen War, Putin, in effect, granted Chechnya the independence it had wanted, but independence de facto, and an independence that is paid for by Moscow. The overwhelming majority, after all, of the funds that head into Chechnya are come from the Federal Treasury, and Kadyrov uses them for his vanity projects, including one of the largest mosques in Europe, named after his dad, as well as buying off all the other members of the elite, maintaining his own personal security forces who may wear Russian military or National Guard uniforms, but are by no means controlled from Moscow, and generally creating a sort of personalistic regime which is based upon flattery, violence and exploitation. I mean, if you really want a kind of specific and frankly quite horrific example, you know, recently there was the report that Ramzan's younger 15-year-old son, Adam, had actually beat up a man by the name of Nikita Zhuravel, who had been charged with burning a copy of the Quran. While Zhuravel was in a holding facility in Grozny. So in other words, actually, you know, it's not just simply they bumped into each other in the street, but Adam went specifically to go there and presumably with the assistance of the prison warders and so forth, but anyway, duffed up this guy. And what we really should consider to be a crime and a sin was presented by, for example, Adam Delimkhanov, of whom more in a moment, Chechnya's deputy at the State Duma. And he presented this as, quote, he showed an example of patriotism and a desire to protect the religion and our sacred objects. But this means that, in fact, we should consider Adam Delimkhanov as, again, quote, as having acted very humanely by letting him live. People deserve the harshest punishments for these actions. So, in other words, the youngest son of the dictator of Chechnya uses his position to go into a prison, beat up a presumably suitably constrained political prisoner, in effect, and that is heralded as a great example of patriotism. Now, I dwell on that because it's just simply an example of the daily litany, not just of arbitrary violence conducted by the Chechen state, which we have to recognise makes the rest of Putin's Russia look like a model law-based state. Anyway, this, you know, it's an example of the arbitrary violence, but also of the personalistic nature of power, the importance of constant flattery of Kadyrov and his clan, and generally the degree to which this is a medieval state. But as I said, it's a medieval state that is paid for by Moscow. And Kadyrov has, time and time again, essentially held Moscow to ransom. Whenever it looks as if the massive federal flows of money towards Grozny might be curtailed, that's when Kadyrov causes trouble. Sometimes he muses about stepping down, retiring, becoming just a common foot soldier or whatever, because he knows full well that Moscow has convinced himself, quite possibly wrongly, but we'll address that later, that essentially Kadyrov is indispensable, that he's the only man who keeps Chechnya under control and therefore avoids the, for them, terrifying prospect of a third Chechen war. So, you know, he muses about stepping down, more or less saying, so, Moscow, you think you got someone else who could run this place? Or else, actually, he becomes even more troublesome than that. I mean, in 2018, for example, Chechen forces launched an incursion into neighbouring Ingushetia, the Galanchoj region, actually suggesting that this was historically always theirs. I mean, so in effect, Kadyrov invaded another part of the Russian Federation to make a point. And again, this is what makes him a conflict entrepreneur, someone who's able to take and, in effect, monetize his role within a conflict. Kadyrov also refused to mobilize on Chechen territory back in September of last year when the rest of the Russian Federation was busy rounding up, you know, 40-year-old bus drivers and whatever to fight its war. He actually said that he would not mobilize on Chechnya. I mean, this is a pretty obvious challenge to Moscow. And although, yes, he then has sent his Chechen forces in, including particularly the so-called Akhmat battalion, but the truth of the matter is that in the main, he has also made damn sure that his forces in Ukraine don't actually have to do any of this nasty fighting and dying business. They essentially concentrate more on dramatic social media videos, which is one of the reasons why they are regarded with what was once a certain degree of amusement, but increasingly is disdain and outright hostility by the rest of the Russian forces, because they are essentially just cosplaying warfighting rather than anything else. Why is this? Well, the Kadyrovtsi, these, you know, essentially personally sworn soldiers of his, they are the bedrock of his control of Chechnya. So in other words, if he allows them to be decimated in Ukraine, that immediately, seriously and directly challenges his position at home. So he's clearly not going to allow that. So he will loudly proclaim his loyalty, his enthusiasm to take on whatever task, to basically suggest that, well, if you unleashed me, we'd be dining in Kyiv in a few days and such like. But in practice, he's going to make damn sure that he keeps his guys safe. Anyway, we've now had, once again, claims that he is seriously ill, that he's in a coma and may well even die. We have to be careful of the sources here, not least because there have been constant claims that Kadyrov is seriously ill, and they tended to come from, well, the Chechen opposition, or increasingly these days, the Ukrainians. That said, this time there have been plausible suggestions that he is ill. Reportedly, a kidney specialist was brought in from Abu Dhabi last year, and there have been suggestions that an attempted kidney transplant went wrong. For that matter, again, showing the sort of medieval barbarity of the regime, there are rumours that he was poisoned, but also rumours that he had his personal physician, Elkan Suleymanov, buried alive, presumably because of a lack of results. Now, that's something that Western healthcare systems don't offer. When Dmitry Peskov, the presidential spokesman, was asked about this, he gave a very non-reply. He said, we have no information on this. In any case, the presidential administration can hardly give out health certificates, so we have nothing to tell you here. Now, such an artful non-answer is in itself, I would suggest, a pretty clear admission that there is something wrong, at least. Because otherwise he'd have said, no, of course not. As far as we're concerned, Kadyrov is as healthy as it comes. But as I said, we need to be a little bit cautious. In March of last year, for example, after the most recent bout of such tales, Kadyrov rather cheekily posted on social media, which is his main way of interacting with the outside world, to those who are entertaining themselves with the hope that I'm incurably ill, I'm sorry to disappoint you. Now, more recently, we've seen videos of him ostensibly just simply visiting in Moscow's Central Clinical Hospital, and a slew of social media posts, including one in which he sincerely congratulates my dear brother Denis Pushilin on taking office as head of the Donetsk People's Republic. And, well, more generally, you know, there's been this attempt to create a little sort of mini flurry of apparent activity, but again, it's all remote. It's all on things like social media, which don't actually tell us much. You know, we've seen videos of him out for a walk in the woods, but again, we don't know if that video was actually recorded a month or a year ago. Now, these most recent claims originated with the Ukrainians, especially their intelligence community. I mean, previously, military intelligence chief Kirilo Budanov had also asserted that Kadyrov was suffering from what he called excessive drug use, which raised an interesting question for me, is what the appropriate drug use was. But anyway, never mind. And look, the Ukrainians clearly have every reason to use every opportunity they can to try and create tensions within the Russian system. They want to, you know, the same way as they talk up issues of Putin's ill health, they want precisely to create a sense that there is kind of an imminent potential crisis at home, because this, in its own way, actually also generates the sort of tensions which may lead to a political crisis. So, yes, of course, they're going to cast doubt on Kadyrov's health, his whereabouts, and his general capacity to govern. But there does seem to be a bit more to it this time. So, you know, although we haven't had to treat it with caution, let's just suggest that it is true that Kadyrov, well, he may be dead, but, you know, otherwise he's dying or faces simply being indefinitely and severely incapacitated. The question is, what then does that mean for Chechnya? And for that matter, what does it mean for Russia more generally? Now, presumably, Moscow would be desperate for a smooth, easy succession. Someone else, ideally, someone who's a little bit more biddable, but anyway, who could basically fill that role of Kadyrov's and, most importantly of all, keep the lid on the Chechen cauldron. The thing is, who could it be? Now, Kadyrov himself had clearly been promoting his eldest son, Akhmat, as his next putative successor, again, you know, as this sultanate becomes increasingly hereditary. The thing is, though, although Akhmat has been presented to Putin and reportedly blooded in battle, he's 17 years old. He is in no way, either legally or politically plausibly, able to become Kadyrov's successor. But what he could do is provide some kind of totemic legitimacy to what is in effect a regency. Now, whether or not he actually would in due course inherit power is another matter, but the point is, in the short term, it could be presented as that kind of provides the Kadyrov stamp of authority to a successor. Now, there are three more obvious sort of potential candidates, one of whom is something these days of an outsider. It's quite noteworthy that when Akhmat was presented to Putin, he was being chaperoned by Ruslan Edelgiriev. Now, Edelgiriev is definitely a former insider in Kadyrov's administration and clearly has Kadyrov's confidence. But he's now actually presidential advisor in Moscow on climate affairs. And by all accounts, actually has a pretty good relationship with Putin and is well regarded in the Kremlin. I mean, at the very least, we can say that he actually understands how things work in Moscow. So in that respect, the hope would be that he's someone who can bridge Grozny and Moscow. But the trouble is, he has been out of Chechnya for some time. And look, in fairness, pretty much like every other Chechen politician, certainly has his share of enemies. And he is vulnerable to the claim that he's just simply Moscow's man, that he has, in effect, abandoned his Chechen roots. Whether that's true or false doesn't really matter when it comes to political smears. It's, are they plausible? And I think they would be. Now, the irony is that the second candidate also spends most of his time these days in Moscow, but nonetheless can still probably make a better case of being, you know, a proper Grozny man. And that would be Adam Delimkhanov, whom I mentioned. Now, he's not just parliamentarian in Moscow. He's also a cousin of Kadyrov's. He is the notional commander of the Chechen National Guard, the Kadyrovtsi, and indeed, it's worth noting, he is a genuine man with a golden gun. Kadyrov presented him with a gold-plated pistol, I presume a Makarov, and likely for his prowess in wiping out Kadyrov's personal enemies. This is a man who actually has been directly accused of being involved in the assassinations of other Chechens opposed to Kadyrov. So, he's certainly a busy chap. But as I say, I mean, I think the thing is, these days he's probably regarded more as a politician than the sort of person who can get his hands dirty. One can wonder, actually, how charismatic he is. He's a good behind-the-scenes operator in Moscow, and absolutely, I mean, his role is in effect to be Chechnya's ambassador, I think is the best way of putting it, with the Russian government. But on the other hand, his power base, especially outside of Kadyrov's own tape or clan, the Benoi, is severely limited. The third possible candidate is the Speaker of the Chechen Parliament, Magomed Daudov, whom Kadyrov himself dubbed Lord for his supposed smartness of attire when he first met him. Apparently he was wearing a black suit and a white shirt, which made him look like an English lord, apparently. Now, Daudov is another one of these fighters-turned-politicians, and he's often described as the second most powerful man in Chechnya. But the reason why I wouldn't present him as a or the front-runner to succeed Kadyrov is because of just how far Daudov's power is precisely as Kadyrov's vicar on earth, and also the bearer of his malice. I mean, Daudov often comes, you know, he made all kinds of threats to Navalny, had a possible role in the murder of Boris Nemtsov in 2015, and so forth. Now, Daudov essentially manages domestic affairs the same way as Dalimkhanov handles kind of foreign relations, including Moscow. But as I said, he's essentially doing this as the vessel of Kadyrov's power, rather than, I would suggest, than that he has a fully fledged power base his own. I mean, obviously he has his clients and such like, but he's just not quite at that point where he has the independent authority. And apart from that, look, I mean, there's a lot of other slightly more marginal figures, or rather people who have a power base, but they don't necessarily have the kind of breadth of support that really stepping into such an all-important position would require. There are political figures like Abu Zaid Vismuradov, also known was Patriot, who is the deputy chair of the Chechen government, and one of his greatest strengths has always been a bit as a gatekeeper in terms of controlling access to Kadyrov. Again, an incredibly powerful position while Kadyrov is the boss, but does it actually give you the political importance to be able to replace him? Uncertain. There's business people like Movsady Aluyev, who he manages the Russian Special Forces University, which is actually a Chechen venture, and in many ways really a way of taking the current need, not just for bodyguards, but also for territorial defence forces and such like, and essentially making that into a money-making venture for Chechnya. This obviously does give him a particular connection with the Chechen Special Forces. But again, you know, essentially, more than anything else, Aluyev is a business person rather than anything else. Conversely, one can look at the side of the Kadyrovtsy. Someone like, say, Apti Alaudinov. Now, he's the current commander of the Akhmat battalion deployed in Ukraine, and also, incidentally, the guy who carried out that 2018 incursion into Ingushetia on Kadyrov's orders. Given, though, that Alaudinov was reportedly recently poisoned, though, he certainly clearly also has his detractors. So, but in general, though, none of these quite strike me as exactly the person with the sufficient capacity themselves as one individual to fill this increasingly outsized space that Kadyrov has carved for himself. Now, look, you know, of course, someone can simply emerge from this political scrum. Moscow could reach in and try and anoint a chosen successor with a mix of threats and also, you know, the promise of continued funding. Carrot and sticks is always the sort of classic imperial tool. However, after almost 20 years of the Kadyrov dynasty, it's unclear just how successful a successor would be in controlling this potentially unruly region. See, on the one hand, you know, it could indeed be a very neat, smooth transition. You, after all, have had 20 years of building a very sort of distinct power vertical within Chechnya, with a lot of people who have a status quo in keeping the situation running, which basically means keeping the money flowing from Moscow. And it could well be that, in fact, there's scarcely a ripple. But what if there's not? What if, in fact, you know, for example, Moscow tries to impose a candidate like Edel Gariev, and this actually generates a pushback from local elites, What if, in fact, we see, for example, divisions within the Kadyrovtsi, as some commit themselves to one contender and some for the other? You know, the possibility of a descent into violence cannot be ignored, and certainly is at the forefront of Moscow's thinking. You know, the rebel movement, such as it was, well, that's basically been destroyed or displaced. You know, where are the Chechen rebels? They're in Georgia, they're in Turkey, they're elsewhere in Europe. You know, they basically do not anymore exist in Chechnya. But on the other hand, again, if there is an opportunity, what we've seen time and time again through Chechnya's struggle for freedom from Moscow's rule, well, Russian rule, actually, because it also included the period when it was Tsarist and under St. Petersburg. But what happens is essentially that whenever the central authority looks weak, that's when nationalist pressure is spawned. And in this case, central authority means not just Moscow, which is clearly rather busy, but also Grozny. So new freedom fighters could emerge from the cities, from the villages, from the mountains. And as I said, this has been Moscow's terror and helps explain the extraordinary latitude that Kadyrov had been granted through his reign, allowing him to make this his own private sultanate. Now, if a post-Kadyrov Chechnya is indeed stable, then Moscow, given that it has other things it wants to spend its money on, might well be tempted to take advantage of this and begin to reduce the eye-wateringly huge amounts of money that flow from the Federal Treasury to Grozny, and which have been used, as I said, for all these various vanity projects, as well as controlling the elite. And the irony is that, in fact, this could even in itself generate precisely the kind of tensions, rivalries, and instability that Moscow had actually been counting on having avoided. So one way or the other, Chechnya could once again become a problem. So then what happens? I mean, this is a really serious strategic challenge for Putin. When 97%, or thereabouts, of your ground forces are committed to Ukraine one way or the other, then how are you then also going to fight a counterinsurgency war in Grozny? Well, in Chechnya as a whole. Do you rely entirely on the National Guard? Which, okay, they are no longer committed in any sort of particular level in Ukraine, but nonetheless, on their own, without the support of the military, other than just Air Force and the like, would they actually be up to the job? Especially if, in fact, they're up against the Kadyrovtsi, who have, after all, been trained and equipped by the Russian state. Viktor Zolotov, the commander of the National Guard, has been promised all this extra, you know, tanks and artillery pieces, but he doesn't have them so far, and Rosgvardia hasn't particularly covered itself in glory of late. And more to the point, yes, there are the so-called interior troops within Rosgvardia, but also, you know, it would have to rely on large numbers of other forces, particularly the Amon riot police and the Sober special operations or police units, kind of SWAT teams. If you are taking these units away from their basing locations all around Russia and sending them to Chechnya, you're doing two things. First of all, you're actually weakening your on-the-ground public order forces in Russia as a whole at a time of increasing public tension, particularly if we're heading, as we head towards the 2024 presidential elections. And secondly, you are also likely to alienate anger as well as kill many of these Amon forces. You're actually therefore going to risk demoralizing them, disenchanting them, at the very time you might well be needing them all the more. So, you know, for all these reasons, this clearly is something that actually could become a real headache for the Kremlin. What happens if Putin is faced with a choice of either withdrawing some of his forces from Ukraine in order to suppress a rising in Chechnya, or losing Chechnya? Which does he choose? I mean, more to the point, could he even actually bring himself to choose at all? We know that his track record is, after all, that when he's faced with very tough decisions, he hesitates and hedges and usually then has some kind of decision forced on him too late, too badly, and by events. One could imagine a situation in which he actually tries to hedge his bets, does both, pulls some forces from Ukraine, enough to make a difference to the fighting there, but not enough to actually grant him victory in a third Chechen war. Which raises the interesting irony of whether or not Ramzan Kadyrov's last legacy might actually be to grant Ukraine a better chance of victory against Moscow. I mean, look, this is a particular, I would suggest, extreme scenario, but it's worth playing out, not just because it may happen, but also because this is exactly the kind of scenario that they will be thinking about in Moscow. I mean, this is the thing that often struck me. I mean, my view was that if Moscow, you know, in times before the war, if Moscow had really wanted to remove Kadyrov, they could have done so. They could have arrested him at some point while he was in Moscow, you know, to get one more medal or anything like that. They could have found some suitable Chechen, again, with the promise that at least for in the short term, the money would keep flowing. I reckon that they could have handled this. I mean, I think this is it. The Russians are very much prisoners of their own literature. They all, at school and everywhere else, were exposed to all these tales of the indomitable Chechens, the wily, dangerous Chechen who, once he's given his blood oath, will hold that above everything else. And there is this sense that you take down Kadyrov and all of these people who've sworn an oath to him, they will be sort of swarming to Moscow, and you'll have this sort of everything from Kadyrovtsi to Chechen organized crime descending on Moscow to cause havoc. I really don't think that that would have been the case. I think that we've increasingly seen that a Chechen elite, which in many ways did come from turncoats who broke away from the rebel movement, especially in fairness as the rebel movement stopped being nationalist so much as jihadist, and we saw an increasing element of extreme Islam become present there. But anyway, you know, these lean fighters have become fat and lazy kleptocrats like everyone else. I think they would have taken a deal. But, you know, I don't think Moscow was willing to think of the Chechens in those terms. Well, that moment, I suggest, to a degree has come and gone. They are more likely now to be faced with a decision which will be forced upon them rather than one that they can take in a time and a way of their own choosing. And I think it's going to be really interesting. And as I say, I don't know if Kadyrov is dead or is dying, but this looks a lot more serious, a lot more plausible than the previous times we've heard these kind of tales. So we'll wait and see. Anyway, enough about Kadyrov and Chechnya. What I want to do is, after the break, I want to talk about this concept more about the conflict entrepreneurs and why, unfortunately, they matter in Russia today, and they will, in my opinion, be a force for continuing the war. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. The Russian sociologist Vadim Volkov came up with a brilliant concept that was then published in English as Violent Entrepreneurs in 2002 by Cornell University Press, in which what he did was he looked at all the discussions about the rise of the mafia in post-Soviet Russia and very much framed it in terms of these so-called violent entrepreneurs, people who have learnt how to monetize the capacity to use or to threaten violence in a system which is unable to control that kind of access and cannot also guarantee protection for individuals. Now, this, I think, is a really interesting term that can also be converted out to talk about conflict entrepreneurs, people who basically use the exigencies of a conflict and find ways of monetizing that. And as a result, essentially, in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, it very much becomes in their interests either to keep that conflict going, or at least keep the threat of that conflict going. So again, it's a conflict or the threat of it. Now, Kadyrov was very much someone who could leverage the constant fear in Moscow that Chechnya could once again explode and it would find itself in a new Chechen war, which would be both, you know, devastating, obviously, for many lives, not that the Kremlin cares for that, but also politically deeply disadvantageous, given that part of the whole Putin legitimacy myth was that this is the man who tamed the barbarous Chechens. So that was something that Kadyrov could constantly leverage, not only his capacity to use violence, whether it was killing individuals like Boris Nemtsov, or more broadly sending an incursion into Ingushetia, but above all, it was about the sort of the fact that I'm also the only person who can actually keep a conflict from happening. Likewise, Kadyrov's dear brother, Denis Pushilin, and the other satraps of the occupied Donbass, ever since 2014, they likewise have been able to enrich themselves and build up their power bases, precisely because they were in the middle of an undeclared conflict and they were able to both tap into the resources that the center was providing to keep that conflict going, but also acquired disproportionate political impact because of the fact that they were in a position to basically modify and influence the process of the conflict one way or the other. Yevgeny Prigozhin of blessed memory, again, another one of these classic conflict entrepreneurs. I mean, up to 2013, he was just one more businessman on the make, who with a certain degree of Kremlin patronage, who'd worked out how to essentially embezzle freely from federal funds while providing certain services, even if not necessarily at a particularly high level. But once the Kremlin had actually induced him to form Wagner, and you must remember, he was originally resistant to the idea, but once that had happened, he became a conflict entrepreneur because it was in his interests for there to be conflicts, because that obviously made Wagner a much more viable proposition. Whether we're talking Donbass, whether we're talking Syria, whether we're talking the conflicts of Africa, or now when we're talking about Ukraine, all of these became market opportunities, and that meant that he had a real incentive to find, inflame, and maintain conflicts that were going on. And I do think that Kadyrov's success over the years in effect blackmailing Moscow was, and I have no evidence of this, but nonetheless, this is my thinking, perhaps one of the reasons why Prigozhin thought he could get away with his mutiny, that he thought it was within the sort of the acceptable rules of the game. Obviously, he was wrong, as he was to discover. But now we have a whole variety of other conflict entrepreneurs who are, on the whole, not kind of big names. And I think this is a really important point that I'll be coming to. But nonetheless, who actually are finding reasons why this war, for them, unlike the rest of the elite, is good for business. First of all, the most obviously sort of mercenaries. There is a whole slew, as I've mentioned, of smaller private military companies, mercenary organizations emerging. Now, these are not like Wagner. They are not, in effect, ones in which power and money connect. People like Oleg Deripaska and Gennady Timchenko, the big name oligarchs, they may well be helping fund, for example, the mercenary organization Redut. But Redut is managed by the Ministry of Defense. Deripaska and Timchenko are not handing out directly their cash and the payments to mercenaries like Roman Empire emperors trying to buy the loyalty of the Praetorian Guard. Really, this is more than anything else like a tax. They have done very well out of the Putinist system, and so the Putinist system is now saying, okay, now we're in a bit of a crisis, it's your time to show your loyalty, reach into your pockets and essentially pay for alternative means of raising extra warm bodies for the front. So they're not directly involved, but there are those making money out of this process. That they are running, for example, the recruitment exercises, they are managing the finances. I mean, these new smaller mercenary companies do seem to be what in the West we would describe as public-private partnerships. in which the state gets what it wants, but that there are private sector individuals who are also involved and who clearly expect to make a profit themselves. The Ministry of Defence is by no means doing it all. And there are new players also coming into this whole business sector. I mean, Alexander Kinstein, who is a parliamentarian who used to be Rosgvardia's kind of ideologist in residence, quite frankly. Anyway, he's pushing a bill at the moment which would allow the National Guard the same rights as the Ministry of Defence to found and support territorial protection units and, in effect, private military companies as well. And there was even talk that, in fact, the Rosgvardia, rather than the Ministry of Defence, might provide a sort of a new home for Wagner. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen at this stage. But anyway, according to one account, Prigozhin's son, Pavel, had actually met with Viktor Zolotov and also one of the senior Wagner commanders, Anton Elizarov, who goes by the call sign Lotus and is, well, another one of those figures rumoured to potentially be one of Prigozhin's possible successors if Wagner continues to be a single mercenary army. But anyway, the suggestion is that precisely they were sounding out Zolotov, or Zolotov was sounding them out, about moving Wagner directly under the Rosgvardia. So, you know, the interesting thing is this is clearly identified as a burgeoning sector. Zolotov may not be the sharpest bayonet in the arsenal, but on the other hand, he has demonstrated a keen understanding of how he can take Rosgvardia and, in effect, turn it also into a very powerful commercial enterprise, often by just simply using its power to squeeze out rivals, take over private security companies and the like. I've actually done a podcast on this, as ever. I'll leave a link in the program notes. So I think in this respect, it is clear that although the Wagner model is dead and buried, Moscow is going to be very, very careful to ensure that there is no similar force with the kind of same degree of autonomy and the same degree of personalistic control as happened before. But on the other hand, there is going to be a rise of a whole generation of new mercenary companies, and that provides clear economic opportunities for some people. But they obviously need them to be used. Second particular sector, reconstruction. I mean, the reconstruction of the occupied territories. One can question actually how far it's going, and certainly the quality of construction. You know, but nonetheless, this is a big business. And even if the headline contracts do go to the big boys, people like the Rotenbergs Stroygazmontage Corporation, in practice, actually, most of this gets farmed out to subcontractors. I mean, in some ways, this is a little bit like the same kind of model as we saw with the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics. That, again, big contracts, but in fact, the real work is done by others, and the big boys just simply sort of basically take their cut and try to avoid actually having to do any of the work. Now, Mariupol alone, for example, which is clearly totally flattened in the war, well, this year sums to the amount of over $1.2 billion have been allocated. Some of it coming from local authorities across Russia, I mean, particularly like St. Petersburg, where the local governor, Beglov, has very much tried to shore up his political position by saying that he'll sort of presenting himself as the saviour of Mariupol. But most of it comes from the federal budget's Special Infrastructure Project Fund, which in total, this is 377 billion rubles, which is at the moment, what, 4.75 billion dollars, something like that, for the period 2023 to 2025. So there is a lot of money in reconstruction. But the whole point is precisely that actually depends on destruction in the first place. Next sector where we're seeing conflict entrepreneurs emerging, provision of everything that the military needs. There's a huge amount of profiteering here. You know, we've had cases of, for example, uniform prices be trebling almost literally overnight. We have all kinds of deeply, deeply substandard equipment being provided. Now, look, this was a problem even before the war. The last real figure we had was some years back from the main military prosecutor, who said that 40% of all procurement funds are actually embezzled. And we saw that in the early days of the invasion, with the notionally sort of scrambled high security radios where if you open up the carapace, the case, inside it's just a cheapy little Chinese walkie-talkie. Likewise, you know, the trucks which are meant to have tough all-weather off-road tyres that turn out to have, once again, common denominator, cheap Chinese junk on them, which very quickly sort of starts to deflate and lacerate. This is not really changing. I mean, we've still got quite a bit of evidence of, you know, everything from dud ammunition, and that's even before they start using.
Herzlich willkommen zum Stubnitz Radio Amsterdam. We'll be right back.
Nu volgt een bommelverhaal dat heel leerzaam is voor iedereen die aan groeistuipen leidt. En omdat vele Nederlanders zich willen ontplooien van kleine ukjes tot vergrijzenden, is dit een uitzending van nationaal belang. Laat ons luisteren naar de mopbeweging. Vandaag vertelt Yvonne van den Hurk de mopbeweging.
Wanneer men vanuit Rommeldam rechtstreeks naar het noorden vaart, krijgt men al spoedig het eiland Starring in het zicht. Maar omdat er niet veel aan te zien is en er ook weinig handel gedreven wordt, varen de meeste schepen er zonder belangstelling langs. Bij gebrek aan een vliegveld is er ook geen luchtverkeer, zodat men van het hele eiland alleen maar weet dat het bewoond is.
Daar huizen wat ongare landkrabben zonder stuwing in hun donder.
Al dus kapitein Walrus, die er wel eens komt om een ladingtje starwortels in te nemen. Aan deze inlichtingen hebben we natuurlijk niet veel. Er zou dan ook geen reden zijn om langer bij dit lapje grond stil te staan, wanneer er op een keer geen verbinding met de vaste wal tot stand was gebracht door enkele jonge starringers, die we hier met een enorme vuurpijl over het strand horen dragen. Het waren Rep en Boel. Twee inboorlingen die in het geheel niet leken op de beschrijving die de gezagvoerder had gegeven. Maar dat kwam omdat zij mops waren die zich in de moerassen plachten op te houden. De kust was voor hen verboden terrein.
Ver genoeg. Zet hem rechtop, Rep. Duw hem diep in de grond. Oké, en nu naar boven. Klim erin. Ja.
Oké, Woel. Ik maak mijn riem vast.
Oké, haal je vast. Ik ga het kruid aansteken en dan ga je.
Oh.
Als dit lukt, hebben we het luchtruim.
Dat is het einde van de vergronding.
Daar ga je, Rep.
De vuurpijl waarop Rep zat, schoot hemelwaarts en boog toen met een flauwe bocht naar het zuiden, een breed spoor van sterretjes achter zich latend. Na een korte tocht over zee had het tuig zijn meeste kruid verschoten, zodat hij begon te dalen en knetterend op een lage fietser afkoers.
Een onbekende vliegende voorwerp. Ach, dit fenomeen heeft mij de hoedespol gans verschutterd. Maar ik moet zijn vlucht snel volgen gaan, daarmee hij mij niet ontkomt. Dit vraagt een wetenschappelijke onderzoeking.
De volgende morgen besloten heer Bommel en Tom Poes een flinke wandeling door de winterse natuur te gaan maken. Ze waren nog niet ver gekomen toen ze professor Prowitzkowski aan de kant van de weg zagen staan.
Der goede dag. Kijkt u dit maar aan en zegt u mij wat u daar ziet. Bitte.
Afval. Tegenwoordig werpt men zijn vuilnis maar overal neer. De politie moet strenger optreden, zeg ik altijd. Maar het helpt niet.
Het lijkt mij een uitgebrande vuurpijl toe. Maar het is wel een erg grote.
Een UFO. Dat is het. Maar wij moeten deze fenomeen wetenschappelijk betrachten. Is de oorsprong buiten aard? Of zouden luizenjongens het op mijn hoedesbol voorzien hebben, vraag ik mij.
Hoedesbol?
De eigendommelijke pfeil pijpte mij gans na over de schedeldak. Hij liet een spoor van sterlijns na, die ik nauwlettend gevolgd heb, totdat ik deze ongevoeg hier in de drekstengel zag. Een nauwlettende onderzoeking is hier op de plaats.
Ja, dat lijkt mij ook. Veel succes, hoor. Die heeft ook altijd wat. Het was een vuurpijl, zoals ik direct al zeg. Heel gewoon.
Ik weet het niet. Hij was wel erg groot.
Oh, heerlijk. Beweging is goed voor een heer van mijn stand. Het bevordert de bloedsomloop en houdt de spieren in orde. Te veel zitten geeft vetzucht, zei mijn goede vader altijd. En daar houd ik mij aan. Daarom heb ik zo'n prima conditie. Uren zou ik zo kunnen voortgaan. Hoewel, men moet niet overdrijven. Laten we hier even gaan zitten, jonge vriend. Mm-hmm.
Oei, niet zitten, niet zitten. Snel, ik moet helpen.
Wat was dat?
Er ontploft iets, een rotje of zo. Ik raak kruiddamp.
Niet zitten, niet zitten.
Wat betekent dat? Wat zijn dat voor streken?
Geen streken, ik ben een mop, vandaar.
Een mop? Ik weet niet wat je bedoelt, maar van dit soort streken zijn we hier in het geheel niet gediend. Ik zou er iets voor voelen om je bij de politie aan te geven. Hoe is je naam?
Ik ben Rep. En toen ik u hoorde praten, wist ik meteen dat u ook een mop was. Beweging is goed, zei u. Zitten geeft vetzucht, zei u. En toen ging u zitten. U loopt grote gevaren. Daarom dacht ik, laat ik helpen.
Maar, wat bedoel je? Kan je niet een beetje stilstaan als ik tegen je praat?
Zitten en stilstaan zijn gevaarlijk. Dan wordt men een stap. Vandaar.
Ach ja. Beweging is goed.
Ja.
Te veel zitten geeft vetzucht, zei mijn goede vader altijd. En daar heb ik mij aan gehouden. Een mop noem je zo iemand, hè?
Ja.
Alleraardigst. Ja, ja, ik ben een mop. Altijd in de weer. Als het niet met het lichaam is, dan is het wel met de geest.
Goed zo.
Maar ik begrijp nog niet wat je met die gevaren bedoelt. Wat is een stap?
Weet je dat niet?
Nee.
Een stap is een mop die vergrond is. De tweede groeistoot. Dat is erg hoor. Daarom heb ik een luchtpijl gemaakt, want ik wil geen stap worden.
De spoor is ganz klar te vervolgen.
Paul,
hier hebben we hem. Een ganz nervöse verschijning met fenomeenaardige trekken. Een labiele karakter, zo te zien. Onderhavig aan grote spanningen en van hysterische aanlagen.
Seine
Nerven sind ganz besonders angespannt. Das hopst mal rund, sondern einen Moment rüster betrachten. Ist hei ob diese Artkogel geboortig? So frag ich mal.
Hei ist ein Mob. Die sind ein bisschen rüstelos von Art.
Was?
Ein Mob? Altijd in de weer, net als ik. Te veel zitten geeft vetzucht en bovendien loopt men het gevaar een stap te worden. Daarom moet men altijd in beweging blijven. Kom er toch bij, professor. Op dit bankje is nog plaats.
Niet zitten, niet zitten.
Huh?
Een mop. Prend. Kan dit stammen van het woord mobiel? Dat zou kunnen. De stap kan dan ja in een stabiel wezen. Dit verdient een wetenschappelijke bestudering. Uit welke land stamt de persoon, ja?
Jongen, niet. Deze mobiel werpt mijn rotje onder het zittersvlak, zodat mijn hoed mij nu over de ogen klemmert. Heeft ja ganz geen eerbied voor een wetenschappelijke.
Hij meent het niet zo kwaad. Ook ik ben pijnlijk getroffen, heer Prilekowski. Maar laat ik me gaan. Nee, ik begrijp de angst van dit ventje.
Help mij uit de hoedesband. Ik wil de behoorde inschakelen.
Dat is een goede beweging tegen de vergronding. Zo gaat het goed.
Ja, ach ja, men kan dit aan mij overlaten. Ik zal mij persoonlijk over u ontfermen, heer Rep. Een ogenblikje. Eerst moet ik de professor even uit zijn hoed helpen. Hij begint al niet te geven. 1, 2...
De mops hebben het niet gemakkelijk. Als ze maar niet zo klein waren en als er maar een oudere was om ons een handje te helpen.
Ja, ja.
Het is nu zo vaak miskleunen, dat zie je aan die vuurpijl. Mm-hmm. Dat komt alleen door gebrek aan ervaring. Ja. Maar ja, alle ouderen zijn staps of vergrond.
Niet alle ouderen, heer Rep. U hebt precies degene getroffen die u nodig hebt. Kom binnen, dan kunnen we eens rustig praten.
Dat is een heel druk en bewegelijk persoon. Ik hoop dat heer Olivier weet wat hij doet. Ik voor mij voorvoel moeilijkheden als men mij toestaat. Net als ik dacht, als ik zo vrij mag zijn. Heer Olivier,
ja?
Uw fauteuil ziet er ontploft uit, als ik zo vrij mag zijn.
Net op tijd. Dat is de ergste stapstoel die ik ooit gezien heb.
Mijn stoel is getroffen door een rotje.
Zal ik deze jonge heer Rep de deur wijzen?
Het komt me
voor dat hier van wangedrag sprake is, wanneer u mij toestaat.
Laat maar, Joost. Ik was daar bijna gaan zitten. En dat is gevaarlijk, want men kan me al te gemakkelijk een stap worden en vergronden. Ik heb dat nooit zo begrepen, maar vandaag zijn mij de ogen opengegaan, zodat ik een wending aan mijn leven kan geven. Als je begrijpt wat ik bedoel.
Zeer wel, heer Olivier.
Laten we voor alle zekerheid de andere stoelen ook maar behandelen.
Net als ik reeds vreesde, er breken moeilijke tijden aan.
Goedendag.
Zielknijper is de naam. Opvoedkundige. Ik heb zojuist een onderhoud gehad met professor Prolitskowski. Het schijnt dat de heer Bommel zich bezighoudt met de opvoeding van een vreemd ventje dat per vuurpijl is aangekomen.
Per vuurpijl? Dat zou me niet verbazen. Het meubilair...